Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, President Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit a federal prison in Oklahoma. His visit is still receiving widespread media attention. He met with six nonviolent drug offenders for a 45-minute conversation, which was recorded for a Vice documentary on criminal justice, and that'll air on HBO in the fall. But who is reporting on the privatization of the $80 billion prison system? Who's following the money and reporting on lobbying? And how do you think President Obama's focus on nonviolent crime shapes views about why mostly people of color end up in prison? That's also been most of the media focus over the past 2 weeks. Today, we're joined by Maya Shenwar. She's editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of the book Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Hi, Maya. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much, Rose. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Eric Markowitz, senior writer with International Business Times. Eric has been reporting on men serving life sentences for selling marijuana, private prison lobbyists spending millions to keep immigrants locked up, and the high cost of inmate phone calls. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Nice to have you. And we're discussing Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's recent visit to the White House. Most of the coverage focused on Boko Haram, whose attacks in the northeastern part of Nigeria have left at least 8,000 civilians dead since 2009 and more than 1 million people displaced, according to Human Rights Watch. And now a lot of focus is on President Obama's trip to Kenya. He will be the first president to visit Kenya, the birthplace of his father. And according to reports, Nairobi residents are right now on a lockdown as President Obama arrives for a three-day visit. And joining us to discuss coverage is Omoyele Sahare. He's a human rights and pro-democracy campaigner and the founder and publisher of SaharaReporters.com. This is a website of citizen journalism that exposes corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. Hi, Omoyele. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Maya, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, actually, in regards to Obama's visit to prison and his commutations, I got a great surprise from MSNBC, which usually I write off a little bit, but I thought that Melissa Harris-Perry's discussion around Obama's proposed reforms and the reforms being considered in Congress was really exemplary because the conversation touched on this issue of dividing up nonviolent and violent offenders. And simultaneously, I think Truthout, where I work, of course, I'm a little biased in favor of it. But we've been covering this issue for a very long time. And today we published a piece by Dan Berger, who's a scholar who looks at political imprisonment. And he talks about some of the roots of this crisis in political imprisonment and how the repression of social movements has actually fueled mass incarceration.
And we'll talk more about this when we discuss this in detail, because President Obama specifically was focusing on nonviolent and drug-related crimes, saying that harsh prison sentences, particularly for nonviolent drug crimes, are to blame for doubling the prison population in the past two decades. And so we'll talk about how his focus on nonviolent crime really shapes views about who ends up in prison, why they're mostly people of color. So kudos to MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry and then Dan Berger, who is writing over at Truthout. And that is Maya Shenwar. She's editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of Locked Down, Locked Out. And thank you for those. And Eric, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm actually going to, if I can, just talk about two pieces very briefly. The first one is from my colleague, Sal Rodriguez. He's our guy in San Francisco. He writes a lot about tech. He focuses on the Silicon Valley community. He has a piece out today that I think is really worth reading. You know, I think Silicon Valley gets a lot of press and attention. It seems like an exciting place to be, to work. You know, companies like Facebook and Twitter are there. I think we also know that, Silicon Valley has a big diversity problem. You know, if you look at the stats and you look at the numbers, it's an overwhelming majority of, you know, white men. It's hard for women and people of minorities to break into this industry. Sal does a good job talking about some of these issues in a new piece. It's actually about tech coding schools that are, he titles it, Independent Tech Coding Schools Are Helping Silicon Valley with Its Race Problem. Really interesting piece. The other one, you know, that's sort of more in line with our discussion today that I think is worth mentioning is a piece from The Atlantic about bounty hunting reform. You know, bounty hunting is something that I think most people just kind of understand as the Hollywood version of it. You know, maybe you've seen Dog the Bounty Hunter or maybe a movie about it, but it's actually a massive private industry. And, you know, the one thing that I think people don't really know about is that this is an industry that's incredibly lucrative and also really unregulated. And the one sentence that I want to just read here from the piece, which I think is very interesting, is that bounty hunters are considered private contractors, but they are authorized to use deadly force when making an arrest. So, you know, here's an example of a private company that's basically given the, you know, the law extends to them the opportunity to make money from this this industry of going out and getting, you know, people who have skipped their bond, and they're basically allowed to act however they want when it comes to making that arrest. And if they need to use force and if they need to use deadly force, then, you know, the law kind of looks at it as, well, you know, they did what they had to do. Mm-hmm. So that was in The Atlantic. That was by Katie Bo Williams, and also definitely worth reading.
And I was just checking this piece out, and she writes that, the, as you said, the hunters usually grab, bounty hunters, grab attention when somebody gets shot, but in many states they're an active part of the criminal justice system.
Right, and so the cops really end up working hand in hand, and the whole, not just the cops really, but it's the prosecutor's office, the judge, the entire criminal justice system, and, you know, they aren't subject to the same sort of oversight that, that police officers are.
Mm-hmm. All right, so kudos to Katie Bo Williams at The Atlantic. The piece is, does the bounty hunting industry need reform? And Sal Rodriguez at the International Business Times, writing about the lack of diversity in Silicon Valley and how these tech coding schools might change that. And that's Eric Markowitz. He's senior writer with the International Business Times, and thanks for those pieces. And what about you, Omayela? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I kind of say that I'm pretty impressed with Democracy Now, especially Lady Nameen Sheikh, who continues to cover Sandra Bland's murder, suicide, as the case may be. I do not seriously follow U.S. media too much these days because it's too much, just too much chatter and, you know, a little substance. But to think, you know, in the midst of all of what's going on, they kept the, you know, the focus and continue to highlight, you know, by interviewing family members and keep the issue on the front burner at a time that I, you know, expect that this may not be around for too long, knowing how people just move on with their lives here. Mm. So I have to give kudos to Democracy Now for keeping this on. So that's something that impressed me, that they've just been doing a lot.
Yeah, they've been doing extensive coverage. And today, I haven't heard it yet, but they were joined by Sharon Cooper, who is Sandra Bland's sister. And Omayela, I'm just curious, from your perspective, because you're based in New York, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so what are your thoughts about all of the attention that this issue is now getting, whether it's Sandra Bland or other people who are killed by police? And what are your overall thoughts about the media coverage?
Well, you know, I came here in 1999, and I think my first experience in the U.S. was when the West African was killed, Amadou Diallo. And there was a huge movement around police brutality, and I'm surprised that these things are continuing to happen. But what I thought was responsible is that, you know, people are very, very quick to move on, including even the media. And I hope that this time around we will not have people just do a few protests here and there and just move on with their lives, because it's not enough to have Twitter hashtags tweeting, everybody tweeting, we have to, people have to put their foot on the ground. And if we can have people massively following up on this, we might be able to get somewhere with, you know, stopping police brutality in this country. It's a shame that this is continuing to happen. But, you know, we also have to thank technology for it. Internet and citizen reporting is helping to expose a lot of these police brutalities in around the country in a way that you just can't cover them up anymore.
And so kudos to Democracy Now! For its coverage of Sandra Bland. And they also had the founders of Black Lives Matter on this morning, three women, as they're convening in Cleveland, Movement for Black Lives conference there. So thank you for that. That is Omeyela Sahare. He's human rights and pro-democracy campaigner and the founder and publisher of SaharaReporters.com. It's a website of citizen journalism that exposes corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. And we will put links to all of these stories mentioned at yourcallradio.org. So, Omeyela, let's dive in and talk about Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's recent visit to the United States. Most of the coverage focused on Boko Haram, whose attacks, according to Human Rights Watch, in the northeastern part of the country have left at least 8,000 civilians dead since 2009 and more than 1 million people displaced. And then it was reported just yesterday that bomb blasts suspected to have been carried out by Boko Haram killed at least 29 people in Nigeria and 24 in Cameroon. What are your thoughts on the focus on Boko Haram in the U.S. around Muhammadu Buhari's visit?
You know, there's a deeper question that, people are not looking at. The United States has been trying to put in place an African command, you know, of the United States military. And it has been one of the projects that failed, seriously failed, because it was rejected and resisted all over, you know, and not only in Africa, but, you know, even in the U.S., a lot of activists didn't want a U.S.-African command on the ground. But I think they are finding resonance with Boko Haram being on the ground in Nigeria and all the violence happening, you know, within Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. I have a feeling that in embracing Buhari and talking about Boko Haram, we're going to have them put on the table again very, very strongly a decision or a request to have an African command. Maybe it will not be called an African command as it was initially designed, because that name just makes people a little scared and they don't want them. But I see that overall, when they're going to come through the back door, the front door, the side door, we're going to have the kind of military presence that the U.S. had always wanted to have on the continent of Africa that they never had. Mm-hmm. So I think that is one major reason why Boko Haram is the issue that was discussed. And of course, you know, if you link that with the fact that, you know, they're making all these connections between ISIS and Boko Haram, you can understand that, you know, along that line, you can tell that, you know, they want to make that very, very important connection or nexus between Boko Haram in a way that, you know, there can be another justification for a global war against terror, you know, and, you know, in general, what this is going to lead to.
And so what are your thoughts on the reporting on that? Because Foreign Policy has a piece called U.S. to Boost Military Aid to Boko Haram Fight. The lead says Washington wants to help Nigeria's new president battle one of Africa's deadliest terrorist groups, but don't expect a fleet of surveillance drones to be part of the mix. What do you think about coverage of that and then just overall coverage of U.S. African Command or AFRICOM?
I was actually surprised that Buhari got, you know, as much coverage as he did during his visit. It made it sound very, very, you know, it made it look like it was very, very important. But, you know, all of them are connected, you know, and covering this the way it was covered and making it a Boko Haram affair as opposed to several other things that could have been discussed. You're having here a situation where, well, one of the things in my view is that, you know, the media feels like, okay, you know, we always discuss Africa, we underreport Africa, and we've always been accused of reporting Africa in a negative way. There is something we can report, you know, an African president who just had democratic won elections and then the opposition is around, and you can see him, and, you know, but in doing that, they've ended up doing the same thing, which is giving Philip to the negativity that, you know, people have always accused them of, which is just, you know, make Nigeria just about Boko Haram as opposed to several other issues confronting Nigerians and Africans. Nigeria is the largest African, the most populous African country, to the extent that the population of Nigeria is half, almost half or more than half of the population of the United States. It's a very, very important country. And Nigeria is not all about Boko Haram, but because that's what we ended up with. It's just Buhari, Boko Haram, Nigeria, Boko Haram, and so on and so forth.
And you had a piece about a prosecution of a former oil minister reporting that Muhammadu Barahai met with Loretta Lynch at the White House. What are your thoughts on how the media are covering the president and what he stands for and his claim that he's going to crack down on corruption?
Well, you know, Buhari, quite honestly, is known to be someone who is one of the least corrupt, you can say, of all the army generals that's ruled Nigeria. And as a matter of fact, he was in power almost 30 years ago. He's been oil minister, president, as a commander-in-chief, and he's headed, another big organization that had a lot of money, and he doesn't even have a gas station. He lives a Spartan life, and so that is part of the reason why he won the election. And I think he can fight corruption, but I don't know if he still has, the belly, the fire in his belly, as they say here, to do so. He's 73 years old. From what we observe on this trip, he's very frail, if not fragile. And quite honestly, he didn't say much. Buhari pretty much said the same thing everywhere he went. Thank the U.S. for helping us, giving us elections. There were not too many sound bites from Buhari throughout his stay here. We actually tried to interview him, and his people prevented us from interviewing him because they said they can't predict what we would ask him. So they preferred people who don't have the background information to interview him, which made him, and so he ended up with Christian Amapo on CNN. So I don't think that he said too much, but people believe that he's not corrupt, and I wouldn't believe he's not, and that as a result, he can cut back on corruption. But we're yet to see that until he puts together a team of ministers and aides and political associates. We can't tell what's going to happen in Nigeria. But people are generally optimistic that he can cut back on corruption.
And before we let you go, Omoyele, we're going to get a lot of coverage in the coming days about President Obama's trip to Kenya. What should we be looking for, and how do you think the media should cover this trip?
Well, the media is already covering it as they wanted to cover it. Again, if you saw what happened, there was a firestorm yesterday from Kenyans against CNN, because CNN actually said that Obama is going to the hotbed of terrorism, as opposed to going back home where his father is from. So what to look for? Well, I don't know that anything spectacular is going to come out of this. As it has always been, Obama hasn't done too much for Africa. Not until he was going to Africa that he was able to negotiate or force the leaders of Ethiopia to release a lot of the journalists that they put in jail. So, but we're going to see a lot of tokenistic talk. But Obama's got some bites, so that's what you're going to get from the media here. You're going to get a lot of that, and plenty of pictures, and plenty of talk about terrorism in Kenya as well. And hopefully, we'll get a lot of pictures from the safari. Right?
That's right. Yes, we've talked about that with some guests before. You always have to have the photos of the safari. Well, Omoyele, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. That is Omoyele Sahareh. He's a human rights and pro-democracy campaigner and founder and publisher of SaharaReporters.com. It's a website of citizen journalism that exposes official corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. And we're going to talk now about media coverage of President Obama's trip to a medium-security state prison in Oklahoma with Maya Shenwar, editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prisons prison doesn't work and how we can do better. Eric Markowitz is a senior writer at the International Business Times, and he's been writing about men serving life sentences for selling marijuana. You've got to read that piece. Private prison lobbyists spending millions to keep immigrants locked up, and the high cost of inmate phone calls. So, Maya, first off, the visit President Obama made to the medium-security prison in Oklahoma received a lot of attention for obvious reasons. He's the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. And a lot of people wondered, why now, a year and a half before you're about to leave the White House? What do you think about the timing?
Well, I think that Obama often makes decisions based on kind of the tide of public opinion. And the tide of public opinion on prison issues has shifted so dramatically since Obama started in office. It used to be that you couldn't even talk about prison reform. Certain very modest reforms would be proposed every year in Congress by just a couple of people, and they would never really even get debated because you had to maintain this front of being tough on crime in order to stay in office. And so, however, over the past couple of years, particularly because state budgets have been crunched and this has been presented increasingly as an issue that conservatives can support, reducing prison populations, it's become something that's actually popular to talk about, that our federal prison population has ballooned, all our prison populations have ballooned, and people are upset about the amount of money we're spending on it. So now this is something that has come to the fore as a public policy issue. So I think it's an important move. I think that the steps that Obama is taking are positive, especially in terms of beginning this process of clemency, in terms of backing some of the reforms in Congress, though I don't agree with all of them. And I think the visit to federal prison was an important symbolic move, but I don't think it was a bold move. I don't think he was breaking any particular ground. He's not getting ahead of public opinion. He's following it.
Eric, what are your thoughts on the timing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with Maya. I think a lot of it has to do with the general cost to taxpayers. That's something that, you know, anyone really can kind of get behind. Hey, it's, you know, less money for taxpayers to you know, reduce the prison population. I think, you know, in Obama's case, there was the tie-in to, you know, low-level drug offenses. And when you look nationally, we're starting to decriminalize, if not legalize, marijuana. I think people are starting to say, hey, you know, a lot of these people are in prison for something that's now totally legal. So why are we doing this? And I think that's part of the timing for his visit as well.
And Michelle Alexander was quoted talking about this issue, professor of law and author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. She says Obama's prison visit, while symbolically important, posed zero political risk. She writes, it's a story of what happens when the perceived interests of white people of great privilege and power happen to align with the interests of poor people and people of color who are suddenly refusing to tolerate business as usual and who are building a bold and rebellious grassroots movement that threatens the status quo. And so after the break, I'd like you both to comment on that and then also talk about media coverage of what he chose to focus on and what reform really means when we're talking about this massive, growing, multi-billion-dollar prison system. 2.5 million people in the prison system. Today, we are joined by Maya Shenhwar. She's editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author of the book Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Eric Markowitz is senior writer at the International Business Times. He's reporting on men serving life sentences for selling marijuana, private prison lobbyists spending millions to keep immigrants locked up, and the high cost of inmate phone calls. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
We invite you to join in this week's weekly media roundtable. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you prefer to write rather than get on the phone, you can send us an email. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up at 11 o'clock, and following that at 12 noon, the Tavis Smiley Show. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up next week, we are putting shows together about the 50th anniversary of Medicare. We'll also talk about the Iran nuclear deal. Rick O'Berry, former flipper trainer turned dolphin advocate, will be here. And we'll talk about transportation in a crowded metropolis. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And if you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of President Obama's visit to a medium security state prison in Oklahoma, we'd love to hear from you. Did you see stories that really looked at the high number of people of color in prison, the privatization of prison, the $80 billion prison system, who's following the money and reporting on lobbying? And then what did you think of President Obama's focus on nonviolent crime and then the media also focusing on that? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're joined today by Maya Shenhwar, editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Eric Markowitz, a senior writer at the International Business Times, and you can find their pieces at yourcallradio.org. So I read that quote by Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, basically saying that there's no political cost to pay here. The New York Times reports that what was once politically unthinkable has become a bipartisan venture, kind of like what you said earlier, Maya. The New York Times says Mr. Obama is making common cause with Republicans and Democrats who've come to the conclusion that the U.S. has given excessive sentences to many nonviolent offenders at an enormous moral and financial cost. This week, Mr. Obama commuted the sentences of 46 such prisoners and gave a speech calling for legislation revamping sentencing rules by the end of the year. So about 5 months to go. Maya, what are your thoughts on how the media really reported on the reforms and this possible legislation and what that would look like?
So I think the problem with a lot of the media coverage here, and this includes progressive media in addition to mainstream media, is that reform is posed as this one thing. Like, if you're in favor of prison reform, yay, we're on the same page. And I think that's really dangerous, especially if we look at the history here, because in the 1980s and 90s, we also had a situation where Democrats and Republicans were working together on criminal justice reform, and it was the criminal justice reform that ended up actually fueling mass incarceration. And so the sentencing reforms that happened around that time were also collaborative. So I think it's kind of a dangerous frame to be in. And we need, I think, to push back on that coverage and challenge the idea that the bipartisan measures that are being proposed here are some sort of magic solution and that this package is the answer. And we also need to point to aspects of the bill that might be actually harmful, particularly harmful for poor communities of color. So an example of that I can give, I think, is that the reforms that are being proposed, in particular the Safe Justice Act, which was introduced in Congress and that Obama has backed, they actually redirect money saved from federal prisons as we reduce those populations. They redirect it into heightened policing in communities. And what that means, I mean, it'll be targeted toward what they call community policing, which sounds really good, but often in the past has actually translated into things like stop and frisk and the arresting of sex workers. And the kinds of targeting that have been discussed in terms of where this funding will be directed are often driven by conservative interests, like the group Right on Crime has mm-hmm. been very vocal in pushing this legislation. And their idea is that, well, we should target crime hotspots, places where a lot of arrests have happened in the past. And what communities are those? Communities of color and particularly Black communities. So I think we need to think in particular about how this quote-unquote reinvested money is going to be used.
And what are your thoughts on that, Eric? You agree with Maya. You've reported that all experts agree that the country's extreme incarceration rates have been driven primarily by 1980s-era three-strikes laws and mandatory minimum sentences targeted at drug offenders. You also report that, according to the Brookings Institute, an African-American man without a high school diploma will face a 70% chance of imprisonment by his mid-30s. Do you think the media did a good enough job of really looking at the data and then also just the high percentage of people of color who are in prison and why that's the case?
You know, I think it's obviously a difficult issue to report because it's such a large issue,
right,
and one that, you know, doesn't really have just, you know, the right bullet point answers. You know, I think Obama's visit was certainly one that was welcomed by a lot of people in the community, both Republicans and Democrats. I think, you know, the 46 sentences that were commuted were really just a token to what's the larger issue out here. I mean, there are close to 100,000 people serving time for drug offenses. And, you know, changing that is going to take more than just, you know, as Maya kind of pointed out, there's no just one magical solution. I think, you know, just tag on to what Maya talked about, I think what's really interesting is, you know, how certain drugs are classified by the DEA, whether they're Schedule 1 or 2, and also how these sentencing arrangements are created, where, you know, the amount of drugs sold or even the amount of intent to distribute can result in really huge sentencing charges. And more recently, I think an interesting story, one that doesn't get much attention, and perhaps because it's somewhat fringe, but I think it's kind of fascinating, is really, you know, the rise of online drug dealing. You know, we'll see stories like Silk Road. But what's particularly fascinating about that is because those drugs are sold through the internet, some of these drug dealers are actually receiving higher sentencing. They're receiving higher sentences because it's being treated as sort of like a web offense as well. So in addition to the drug dealing, the law kind of looks at it like, well, you're also perpetrating an internet crime in addition to the drug dealing. So there's some, you know, just overall overhauls needed in how we sentence drug offense and how we think about, you know, what these crimes are really kind of all about.
How are you able to find the men you featured in your piece? These men are serving life sentences in prison for selling pot.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
How are you able to find the men that you featured in that piece?
Oh, I see. So there's actually a couple of people that are beginning to look at this issue more seriously. So the background on the men serving life sentences for pot offenses, there's really no actual official data on this. It's not like you can just go to the government's website and say, hey, how many men are serving life sentences? So it's really the work of a couple of activists. The one I happened to speak with for that article, her name is Beth Curtis. She runs a website called lifeforpot.com. Her brother is a guy named John Nock, and he's serving a life sentence for importing, you know, she admits he did import quite a large amount of marijuana maybe 20 years ago, but he's serving a life sentence without parole. And, you know, she's fighting for some attention around this issue, potentially for her brother as well as some of these other men to be granted clemency. But it's really on her effort, you know, a grassroots effort to locate some of these men that are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. And, you know, some of them are not, you know, they're not like drug kingpins. You know, they're not like the people that we'd imagine are serving life sentence for drug offenses. These are guys who definitely maybe did something wrong, but they're serving life sentences because of the amount, not because of any violence or, you know, horrible things that they've done to another human being.
There was a piece in Courts by Noah Berlatsky, and he quoted Marie Gottschalk, author of Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. And she writes, if we released everyone now serving time in state prisons whose primary charge is a drug offense, we'd reduce the state prison population by 20%. And then Noah writes, Berlatsky at Courts, Obama and politicians on both the left and the right are just beginning to acknowledge that America has too many people in prison, but the problem is still too often framed as a technical glitch. Some good people have ended up in a place for bad people, the White House suggests. Fiddle with drug laws or sentencing lengths, and the good people can be released, and all will be well. Maya, what are your thoughts on that statement?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. So even if the U.S. released all of its federal drug offenders, And actually, if we released all of our drug offenders in state prisons as well, we would still be the most incarcerated nation in the world. We would still be winning that title. And I think beyond that, just on the moral front, it's really, really problematic to make this very thick distinction between nonviolent and violent offenders. And in so many situations, convictions for violent offenses are fueled by the same structural racism, the same structural classism that fuels nonviolent offenses and that creates the conditions for those. And so I think if we're talking about the criminal legal system as a product of racism, as a product of slavery, as a product of Jim Crow, then we have to acknowledge how violent offenses can be grounded in that structural racism and classism as well. And I think, like, also just, like, on a gut level, this idea of saying some people are like us, like Obama mm-hmm. said, some people are in this category of doing stupid things. I did stupid things when I was a kid. You know, some people are in that category of innocence. And then there are the bad, evil, hardened criminals. It makes it seem as if they're a different species of human based on what might have been the worst moment of their lives, what was, you know, one of the worst things they ever did, and certainly caused harm in many cases. But I think we all need to think about whether we would want the worst moment of our lives to define us and determine the entire rest of our lives. You know, so I think it's also a moral question, and we can't neglect that. In addition to recognizing that releasing nonviolent drug offenders will not end mass incarceration.
Maya Shenwar is editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author of the book Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. And she writes from a very personal perspective because her sister spent time in jail. Eric Markowitz is a senior writer at the International Business Times. He's been reporting on men serving life sentences for selling marijuana, private lobbyists spending millions to keep immigrants locked up, and the high cost of inmate phone calls. And if you have any thoughts on the media's coverage of President Obama's trip to a medium security prison in Oklahoma last week, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on how this massive issue is being covered at a time when so many in the media focus on the fact that Democrats and Republicans are now on the same page on this issue, prison reform? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Eric, as you said, there are so many layers to this issue, and you have some incredible reports. Let's talk about you've got a number of pieces about the high cost of inmate phone calls and how this has become a lucrative $1.2 billion a year business.
Yeah, so I mean, I think most people at this point, they have a cell phone. You know, they make calls, they pay their $80 a month or whatever it is for their cell phones. They may sort of begrudgingly pay for it, but it's not an overwhelming cost. In prison and jail, it's a different scenario. All of the jails and prisons are equipped with phones that are run by private companies. And the way it works is, you know, these companies basically win contracts to provide the service with jails by saying, you know, if 1,000 inmates make a call in a week, we'll give you a percentage of the revenue of each of the call. So over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen these private companies grow into very, very big businesses by raising the prices of phone calls so that, one, the jails and prisons can get a bigger commission of that call, and two, that they can themselves reap bigger profits from this. So in one particular story I wrote recently, I wrote about a woman named Joanne Jones. Her son is incarcerated in Texas. He got arrested for aggravated robbery in January 2014. She had never really dealt with the phone system before, but in the year that he's been locked up, you know, she's racked up over $1,000 in these calling fees for really just like short calls. A 15-minute call, for instance, costs about $10.
Wow.
To do a video call, which they now have, costs anywhere from $8 to $20 per call. as she's told me and as she's shown me, the quality of those calls is not great. Sometimes the call drops, the video is grainy. It's really not a great experience. And really, at the end of the day, it's the companies and frankly, the local sheriff's departments that are profiting pretty wildly off of this system.
You report that, and I've never heard of these companies, Securus and GTL are the two largest players in the prison phone business. Together, they control 80% of the market.
That's right. So the prison phone business has grown to approximately a $1.2 billion a year in revenue business. It's controlled mainly by two companies. One is Global Tellink, that's GTL. The other is Securus Technologies. I've written quite a bit about Securus, but if any of you have ever listened to the popular Serial broadcast, there was a couple of stories that came out after that about this reporter who had spent time talking with a prisoner for a story she was doing. She spent about $2,500 reporting the story because she had to call the prison so often. So that was just an example of just the exorbitant fees and rates that she was dealing with.
How transparent are these corporations? What is it like to report on this issue?
Well, frankly, it's not easy because these are not corporations, actually. These are private companies, and they are not legally required to disclose any of their financial information. And so it's very difficult to get transparency around how they're making money, how much money that they're making. And, they're a pretty litigious organization. If you look through court filings, they're suing a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. They're very secretive. They protect their intellectual property dearly. They do not like to speak with the media. In fact, they've, to my knowledge, never offered an interview to anyone, especially me. They kind of operate without much oversight. The FCC right now is actually looking into regulating this industry. And so these companies are now having to answer to federal regulators about why they charge such high rates, why they charge such high fees. And the result is likely in the next few months we're going to start seeing federal regulators clamp down on this sort of price gouging that they're doing.
And that's Eric Markowitz, senior writer at the International Business Times. His piece is about this massive industry, $1.2 billion prison phone industry. You can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And Maya Shenwar is editor-in-chief of Truthout, author of Locked Down, Locked Out. Maya, in May, you had an op-ed in the New York Times called Too Many People in Jail, Abolish Bail. And since then, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio unveiled a plan that would reduce bail or get rid of bail for low-level crimes. Can you give us an update on that? That was just announced.
Yeah. I think that the reform is a lot less exciting than a lot of people have been portraying it. It wouldn't get rid of bail, but it would provide the discretion to not give bail to let people out instead of requiring monetary bail for a number of low-level offenses. And I think that this is a really positive step. I don't think it's a backtrack, but whenever these kind of small tweaking reforms happen, I get a little worried because, particularly since the media likes to oversimplify things, or at least most media, you get these stories that say bail has been abolished in New York City and there are still many people who are behind bars because they can't pay their way out. I do think, though, that it's encouraging that over the past couple of months, there has been a lot more attention on the fact that so many people are in jail because they can't pay these relatively small bail amounts to get themselves out.
Right.
And so we're punishing poverty.
And in your piece, you point out that 79% of pretrial detainees were sent to Rikers because they couldn't post bail right away. Mm-hmm. And Khalif Browder, on May 15th, 2010, he was arrested in the Bronx for allegedly stealing a backpack. He said he didn't steal it. Now, his mom could not afford $3,000 in bail, $3,000. So he was sent to Rikers, which is a jail notorious for its horrible treatment of young people. Khalif Browder spent 1,110 days behind bars, 800 in solitary. He was never convicted or given a trial. All charges were eventually dismissed, and he hanged himself 2 years to the day after his release. He was only 22. So someone like Khalif Browder, whose mom couldn't afford the $3,000 bail. Is this the type of person that de Blasio is talking about? If this had been in effect, would Kalief even have gone to Rikers?
I do think that de Blasio's reforms were partially in response to the coverage around Kalief Browder's case and the cases of other people in his position, particularly because Kalief Browder spent such a long time in jail. And this is something that I think we have to be aware of, is like, it's not just, oh, you can't pay bail, so you're going to be in jail for a couple of days. For some people, it's months or even years. And so I think, I mean, depending on how that reform would be implemented, you know, we can't really tell who would benefit and who wouldn't. We'll have to see how that plays out in practice. And I think sometimes, like, a reform happens and it's like, oh, that would have, you know, reversed whatever happened to this person, or it wouldn't have happened in the first place. But with this reform, I really am not sure it would have made a difference.
And now we have a video from Sandra Bland of a voicemail, and she left a voicemail for her friend expressing sadness over her $5,000 bail over a very minor traffic violation. This is just getting international headlines now for obvious reasons. Sandra Bland, again, was stopped for a minor traffic violation. We're now seeing the video of the Texas trooper saying that he's going to light her up, you know, put out your cigarette. He reaches into the car to grab her out, and then she was found hanged in her prison cell 3 days later. Maya, what are your thoughts on the reporting on this, beyond the just here are the facts reporting?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's good that this case has been getting so much attention. The problem that I've been seeing, or one of the several problems, has been that there's been so much push to kind of brand Sandra Bland in a certain way, to focus on the fact that she wouldn't put out her cigarette, to focus on the fact that she was talking back, and to kind of impose all these stereotypes around black women, at the same time as she's getting treated so brutally by a police officer and being subjected to this violence, it's being kind of like placed back on her in this horrible twist of personal responsibility. And so I think, and this goes for a lot of cases of police violence, that this kind of immediate instinct to say, okay, what did the victim do? Right. You know, it is really, really troubling.
What are your thoughts on that, Eric? I found a piece at forharriet.com. I never heard of this before, but it's in her own words, the haunting importance of Sandra Bland's Sandy Speaks videos. On a regular basis, she got in front of the camera and just talked about what we're dealing with in this country. And she said, quote, being a black person in America is very, very hard. We can't help but get pissed off when we see situations where it's clear that black life didn't matter. And so it's Sandy speaking in her own words. She talked a lot about Black Lives Matter. What are your thoughts about how the media are using her own words?
Well, I think it's kind of, you know, pretty typical for a situation where someone, you know, I think we see it in a lot of different ways, where something happens to someone, where they're a victim of a crime, or even if they're a perpetrator of a crime, and the next story becomes, let's dig in through their online history. Yeah. Let's go through all the comments that they've made and, you know, any YouTube video that they've uploaded. I haven't watched the particular videos that you've mentioned, but I think, you know, it's tough to report on these issues because the person in this case, frankly, it's very sad, and she's passed away. We can't get her side of this.
Right.
And so I think that there, you need to be, as a journalist, very aware of that fact and present the material in a way that I think reporting on it is okay, but providing sort of a balanced measure and not reading too deeply into it or trying to interpret it in any particular way is important as well. I think presenting the facts is fine, but interpreting it or trying to analyze it without too much context is really unfair.
And now law enforcement officials in Waller County have concluded that the cause of her death in police custody was suicide. Her family and her friends still dispute this, and they're going to call for an independent autopsy. So how do you report on that when you've got law enforcement saying it was a suicide, her family says there's no way this could have happened?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tricky part of journalism, right? I mean, you can't. I think it is a national news story. It is newsworthy. I think reporting on suicide or potential suicide is a very dangerous and tricky thing. And I think there's a lot of guidelines that should be applied when speaking about it. I think at this point we just don't really have enough facts to speak conclusively about it.
What are your thoughts, Maya?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I also think the more that can be done in the media to center Sandra Bland's family and friends and allow them to speak and allow them to bring forward the context of the situation is really important. And actually, that's something Democracy Now! is doing very well. And I think the focus on the results of this initial investigation, I don't think that we should put all our stock in it. I think that there needs to be more investigation. I think that there needs to be more coverage that spotlights the thoughts of the family and the experiences of the family, and that the more that we do that, the more that not only will we understand this case, but understand the broader context.
Hmm. Maya, what are you working on right now?
Well, right now, Truth Out is kind of shifting focus and looking at the ways that we can cover prison reform in a way that isn't doing this kind of like blanket endorsement. So both in terms of my editing and my writing, I'm thinking about how we can do that. One thing personally that I'm working through the initial stages of is a project that looks at kind of all of the ways that prison is being translated into some of the structures that are being built in the name of prison reform. So, for example, when we're talking about drug sentencing that doesn't involve sentencing people to prison, but instead placing them in drug treatment centers, are we building drug treatment centers that look like prisons? Are we sentencing people to electronic monitoring and therefore imprisoning them in their homes? Is that the alternative to prison?
And Maya Shenhua is editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author of Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Eric Markowitz is a senior writer at the International Business Times. Eric and Maya, thanks for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.